Good evening. I dropped into a little soda shop the other noon to get a chocolate frap because I didn't have time to get a boiled dinner. And I overheard two women talking. What do you mean you and Charles can't play bridge on Wednesday nights anymore? We always play then. What's the matter with that man? The other woman shook her head. Charles, she said, will be on duty every Wednesday night for the duration. He's joined the Coast Guard Temporary Reserves. Can you imagine my husband poking round a lumbyard with a policeman's billy and a flashlight all night when it's 5 degrees below zero? You know how cold his feet get when we go riding. Well, the other woman said, we'll have to get back to playing on Saturday nights, if that's the way it is. You come over early and help me mix the drinks. Oh, we can't come Saturday nights. Charles has to drill that night, so he'll know how to patrol on Wednesday night. 8 hours duty on Wednesdays and 4 hours drill on Saturdays. And he's so all in on Thursdays, he can hardly keep awake. I don't know how he stands it. But Clara, he loves it. He says those TRs are the finest men he's ever met. It occurred to me that a lot of you lovely ladies might like to know just what your unsung hero husbands are doing night after night on shore and harbor patrol. So when I got back to my office, I called up Lieutenant Charles Ashley, commanding officer of the Coast Guard detail at Constitution Base, and told him I'd like to take a turn around the harbor some night and afterwards go patrolling with the TRs. Later, I reported at Constitution Base and was turned over to Lieutenant Howard Perry and his aide, Bosun's Mate Third Class Warren Freeman, Jr., and together we walked down the wharf and climbed aboard a patrol boat. I was introduced to the skipper, Mr. E.L. Sennett of the John Hancock Company, who took the wheel as we slipped quietly out into the harbor. The air was sharp and the wind was picking up, and it felt good to have a deck under my feet again as the first big wave rolled over the bow and a sheet of water sloshed down the windshield and froze the minute it struck. The wiper stopped, and Coxswain Sheehan scrambled over the slippery deck to scrape off the ice so the lookouts would have a clear view of everything that floated on or flew above that wildly churning water. We nosed into a channel between great mountains of soft coal, and Lieutenant Perry said quietly, "The TRs spotted a fire in that coal pile a few weeks ago, and the boys put it out before anything happened. It could have been very serious." All the time, each man on that boat was quietly watching, watching for the slightest sign of trouble, watching for a single floating log that might foul the propeller of a transport, watching for boats or barges that might have broken loose in the gale. And I was busy looking at the shadowy forms all around us. Why, folks, it seemed to me as if the whole Atlantic fleet was there, bristling with guns and tugging at anchor chains, as if anxious to be out and on the way to battle. We swung close to Commonwealth Pier, and the years rolled back to a wild and windy night 26 years ago, when I, tall and skinny and scared of the rats, stood guard on that long and lonely wharf. But now that place is ablaze with lights that shine on the smooth, sleek sides of warships that put to shame the ones that I knew in the last World War. On one side of the pier, there was a funny-looking craft, covered with life rafts and other things that I can't talk about, and through the gathering darkness, I made out the letters LST. I wonder where she's disgorging tanks and half-tracks and camouflage soldiers tonight, thanks to the TRs, who have released hundreds of regular Coast Guardsmen for convoy and assault duty. It calmed down a bit as we turned toward East Boston and came along the side of the dry dock, where a dozen black hulls loomed above us. Thousands of high-power lights swung in the sky, and around them, like 10,000 ants, workmen and welders wielded hammers and drills and blowtorches as they swung from their ladders and bosun's chairs. Why, the whole waterfront looked like the World's Fair when the fireworks were sizzling above the lagoon. In Chelsea Creek, the water was quiet and oily, and as we neared the Navy Yard, another bedlam of noise and smoke and flame and light blazed in orderly confusion. And there, in the midst of all the new destroyers, the escorts and corvettes and cruisers and battle wagons, the tall spires of old Ironsides rose slender and white against the night sky. By golly, I tell you, the Charlestown Navy Yard is some sight when you see it from the waterside after dark. And don't forget, folks, among the men who protect all this are the fellows who used to play bridge and go to the movies. Well, we got back to Constitution Base just in time to witness the muster at 11 o'clock. The deck was crowded with 200 or more men, putting on watch caps, sheepskin coats, and leggings. A whistle blew, and the men lined up, 48 TIs on one side, 68 regulars on the other. A couple of CPOs called the roll and announced the assignments like this. Detail 701, Railroad Terminal. Johnson, Smith, Follinsby, Sweetser, Turner. And from both sides, men stepped forward to form a squad. The first man called is the coxswain. That is, he's in charge. And to a snappy, right, face, forward, hutch, they were off down the companionway to the armory, where each man signed up for a cartridge belt, a .38, some slugs, a nightstick, and a flashlight. They piled into a covered truck and rolled out into the cold, dark night. A dozen groups were thus assigned, some to go down the harbor on the explosive detail, some to guard the docks and warehouses, and others to plod along the windy, surf-swept shores. The regulars who were left hit the sack, meaning they could lie down on the berth deck one flight up. You see, a constant detail of regular Coast Guards is kept at the base for any emergency, such as a fire, a riot, or a catastrophe. And these standbys sleep with everything on but their shoes. Now, said Lieutenant Perry, we'll go out and take a little trip and see what these fellows do for 8 hours every night. We climbed into a converted beach wagon called the Carryall and dashed down cold, dreary, dark Atlantic Avenue till we came to a side street and turned in between some lumber piles and a fence with barbed wire on top of it. It was pitch dark, and the lieutenant whispered to me, put your hand in that hole and unlatch the gate. Crawl through and see how far you get before you stop. Oh, yeah, and get a bullet in my head? Oh, no, he said, you won't get shot if you stop when you're challenged. Go ahead. I didn't think much of that idea, but I obeyed orders, and I hadn't taken 3 steps when a flashlight blazed in my eyes. It's okay, buddy, I said. The CO is with me. Don't shoot. And when he saw the gold braid, he saluted. But he turned to me and said, I want to see your pass just the same. We stumbled down the tracks, the fine snow sifting down our necks. My fingers were numb with the cold, and I was glad when Mr. Freeman motioned us into a warehouse. But do you know, it was colder in there than outdoors. Damp, I mean. A raw, cold, cutting dampness that went right to the marrow of your bones. A long line of little red blinking lights twinkled all over the place. The fire alarm boxes. And I saw extinguishers and foam tanks and fire trucks and pails of water and sand everywhere. The railroad tracks ran right through the terminal. And it seemed to me that there was enough stuff in that one place to feed and clothe and equip all the people in London. And pacing slowly back and forth were 2 of the TIs I had seen at the muster, their sharp eyes peering behind the piles of goods and into every corner of that long, dark, windy terminal. Again we climbed into the carryall and rumbled on till we came to the most godforsaken part of the waterfront. The wind roaring in from the sea made our eyes run, and the only shelter was a tiny shack that the TIs had nailed together out of scrap lumber. A truck rolled up bringing hot coffee from the base. One of the TIs came in, brushing the frost from his fur collar. I asked him why he had joined the Coast Guard Temporary Reserves. He coughed a couple of times and said slowly, in the last war, some of my buddies were killed in France because the ammunition wagon didn't reach us in time. Now, I've got 2 sons in the army. And if patrolling this vital area will help to get those boys the stuff they need, it's worth it, isn't it? And one night when Captain Meals, he's the captain of the port, was making an unannounced inspection along the beaches, he bumped into one of the patrols and asked the same question. Why did you enlist in the reserves? That citizen straightened up and said, I lost my brother in the Aleutians, sir. We were inseparable in peacetime. Worked together, lived together, and we always talked over our hopes and plans and troubles. He was all set to come home, and we were going to sit down and talk our heads off. But when I heard he'd been killed, it seemed as though I had to talk to him about it. So I joined the TRs, because, sir, on this lonely beach at night, I can talk to myself, and somehow I feel that my brother Bill is walking along the beach with me. Lieutenant Ashley tells me that only 5% of all the men who enlist as TRs are washouts. Some can't take it. Others find it interferes with business. A few who join for the sake of wearing the uniform soon get tired of the novelty. But the other 95% are in for the duration, with the same determination and spirit and self-sacrifice that has forever marked the glorious history of the United States Coast Guard. You might be interested to know how many men have enlisted in the temporary reserves. Well, there are 20,000 in the whole country. And half of them, I'm proud to say, are right here in the 1st Naval District. That is, between Eastport, Maine, and Point Judith, Rhode Island. In Greater Boston alone, there are 6,000 from every walk of life and every profession. The most amazing thing, I think, is the way the TRs, who get no pay whatsoever, and the regulars get along. Lieutenant Ashley tells me that, for instance, once a week, a big limousine draws up in front of the base. A chauffeur gets out and opens the door for a stoutish gentleman in a fine fur coat and expensive hat, which he takes off and puts carefully on the back seat of the car. Then he dashes inside to become for 8 long hours a third-class seaman and very likely takes his orders from the grease monkey who cares for his automobile in the neighborhood garage. Along about daylight, when this elegant gentleman comes dragging his blistered feet into the base, there's his limousine waiting for him. But when it leaves, it has more than one passenger, for that millionaire has made a lot of new friends in the TRs. So he says, "What do you say, boys, to coming home to breakfast with me? And if you want to take a little snooze, well, I guess there'll be room enough in my big house." You know, 10 years from now, after the Nazis have been put in their place and the Japs wiped off the face of the earth, some freckle-faced kid will climb up on his grandpa's knee and ask, "Grampy, what did you do in the war?" And grandpa, thinking of all those nights when the sleet froze on his mustache as he stumbled over the slippery old wharves in the darkness, will say, "Oh, I wasn't in the war, sonny. I was too old to do any fighting. I was just a TR." And then while he puffs on his pipe, he'll think of that endless bridge of ships racing across the stormy seas to the beachheads of Bougainville and Attu in the invasion coast of Europe. He'll remember all the guns and tanks and planes that were landed, and the orange juice and potatoes and blood plasma that made the Yanks the strongest, sturdiest fighting force in the world's history. And he'll smile and say, "No, sonny, I didn't do any real fighting, but I stuck around to see that the boys who did go to the front got what they needed on time." As I said before, there are 20,000 TRs in the whole country, and 10,000 of them are right here in the 1st Naval District. There's no use talking, folks. You can't beat the Yankee spirit.